The first speaker is going to be Professor Nasamyacharya, who recently retired in the head of the Department of Vaishnavism at the University of Chennai. His special subjects include the pre-Ramanuja religion and philosophy. He is master in Sanskrit as a spoken tongue. The other speaker needs no introduction. Those of you who were here at the first lecture, none other than Professor Francis X. Clooney, S.J. He is the Professor of Theology and Director of Graduate Studies at the Boston College, USA. And he has taught there since 1984. I will now request Professor Nasimacharya to come and address us. Ladies and gentlemen, what we are going to do is this, that there's going to be a speech for 25 minutes, and then I will invite Professor Clooney to speak, and then there will be question and answer sessions. And all of you have been given a piece of paper where if you want anything to ask any of the two learned gentlemen, then please write down and the questions will be given to them for them to answer. Take your last for about half an hour, and we hope to finish the formal part for 10 past 9 for dinner at 1 past 9. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Professor Nasimacharya.
शैवाः समुपासते शिवयति यम शैवाः समुपासते शिवयति ब्रह्मेति वेदान्तिनः बौद्धाः बुद्धैति प्रमाणपटवः कर्तेति नैयायिकाः अर्हम् इत्यथ जैनशासनरताः कर्मेति मीमांसकाः सोऽयं वो विदधातु वाञ्छितफलं त्रैलोक्यनाथो हरिः. फ्री ट्रांसलेटेड इट मीन्स मे द सुप्रीम ब्रह्मन कंफर अपॉन यू व्हाट एवर यू डिजायर. ही इज बीइंग वर्शिप्ड बाय द शैवाइट्स एज शिव एज सुप्रीम ब्रह्मन बाय द वेदांतिन्स as the Buddha by the Buddhists, as Karta the creator by the Logicians, as Jina by the Jainas, as Karma ritual by those who believe in the validity of the Vedic ritual, and as Vishnu by the Vaishnavas. This sets the trend as it were for what I'm going to speak this night. I'm going to speak about the characteristics of a true Hindu, as you will see from my own standpoint. A Hindu basically is the Supreme Brahman who has several names and forms. This is going to be the chief point of my talk today. Well, it gives me immense pleasure to stand before you this evening and to share with you all a few thoughts on what a Hindu is. And I am grateful to Sri Chaunakaji and the office bearers of the IK Foundation who have given me this glorious opportunity of meeting you all. It's a big gathering I never imagined in my life. It's a fantastic experience I have here, and I'm thankful to the organizers for this glorious opportunity. I am proud to be a Hindu and to belong to a nation which from time immemorial, with its rich, ancient, and revealed traditions of religion and culture, has inspired, has influenced the thinking and living of innumerable people all over the world. I am going to place before you certain views regarding the origin of the term Hindu, the connotation of it, how the word Hindu or Hinduism is to be understood in modern times and what promises this religion holds out for future generations. I am presenting these views before you purely as one who was bred and brought in an orthodox Hindu family in a tiny village in South India. The word Hindu, I must concede, is a very complex term conveying several ideas which underlie the religion and philosophy, art and architecture, culture and literature of the Indian nation, with its roots going deep into the dim past of which history has no record at all. Let me trace now briefly the origin of the term Hindu. It was the Persians who for the first time used the word Hindu to denote those people who were living on the banks of the river called Sindhu, which of course is also known as the Indus to the natives. Then later on the Greeks picked up this word. They used the word Indu, I-N-D-U, to denote these people. And you know the word India and Indian, which are quite popular all over the world, are the derivatives of this word Indu, I-N-D-U, used by the Greeks. Later on, the Muslim invaders around the 10th century AD or so began to use the word Hindustan to denote the land inhabited by these people. That is briefly about the origin of the word Hindu. If you go to the early literature we have in Sanskrit, the Mahabharata, the great epic as it is called, has the word Bharata as the name of the land as well as the people inhabiting space. It actually goes back to the name Bharata, the king who ruled the country. He indeed was the son of King Dushyanta Shakuntala, whose love story has been immortalized with the great poet Kalidasa in his wonderful drama called Abhijnana Shakuntala. So only descendants of the king Bharata became Bharatas. In the Bhagavad Gita, for example, Lord says Arjuna is addressed by the Lord as Bharata. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati Bharata abhyutthanam dharmasya tada atmanam sujanyaham. Then comes the Bhagavad Purana, where in book 4 there is a reference to another great person called Bharata, son of King Rishabhadeva, who ruled the country, and then the whole land is named after King Bharata. That's what the Bhagavad Purana says. In later literature, in the subsequent Puranas, which of course very difficult to date in history, we have references to India as Bharata Varsha and Bharata Khanda. Even today, if you do any kind of ritual, or do a sankalpa as it is called, Asmin Bharata Varshe, Bharata Khande, Krishna Kaveri Madhya Deshe, etc. Staying there and doing this kind of sankalpa. Thus, the word Bharata Varsha refers to the country, Bharata Khanda to the Indian subcontinent. The Indian subcontinent, it will be noted, is referred to as part of what is called the Jambu Dvipa. Jambu Dvipe Bharata Varshe Bharata Khande. That is the island of rose apple trees. Now, all this put together, what does it mean? What is the overall implication of the term Hindu? And who is a Hindu? So in theory, let us have a few ideas. The Hindu is one who believes in the authority and validity of the revealed scripture called the Shruti. It's called Veda as well as Vedanta. Veda Anta, the end portions of the Veda, another name is Upanishad. So one who believes in the validity of these scriptural texts regarding the matters of dharma, what to do and what not to do, I must go to the scripture only. That's what Lord Krishna also has in the Gita. Tasmat shastram pramanam te, karya akarya vyavasthito. What to do, what not to do, what is scripture can guide you. So that is the way in which Hindu quotes the scriptures. And again, a Hindu is one who believes in the existence of one supreme God, with or without form, with or without qualities. We may call him Sakara or Nirakara, Saguna or Nirguna. We may worship him either in a temple, in the form of a consecrated image, or in your own heart through meditation, culminating in yogic concentration or samadhi. Well, religion, therefore, for an average Hindu, is something natural, is not a concussion. And Hinduism is not a fossil, is not a relic of the past, it is a vibrant living force today. The Rig Veda has laid down the golden principle of the unity of God in all forms of life, with sentience or without sentience. Let us take a look at the Rig Veda, supposed to be the earliest of the Vedic literature. Here we have a beautiful statement. The manifestation, the meaning of which is the entire generation. Om Indram Mitram Varunam Agni Mahuhu Atho Divya Sasuparno Varutman Ekam Sad Vipraha Bhagha Vadanti Agnim Yamam Matarishvana Mahuhu Ekam Sat. What exists is one, but Vipraha Bhagha Vadanti. Wise men call it by different names. You may call him Indra, I will call him Chandra. Somebody will call him Varuna, somebody by a different name. But the truth remains that we are referring to one and the same God. That is the basic principle of Hindu religion. A Hindu, therefore, is one who believes in the doctrine of karma and rebirth. I am born here as a result of what I did in my past, and what I do now will be the foundation for my future birth. Good or bad, I have to trace back to our own activities. That is what is called the karma siddhanta, the doctrine of work done by us. As a result, man is born again and again till a guru comes and then helps him out. This is what the Hindu basically believes. And a Hindu is one who believes that liberation from the worldly transmigration is possible because you may have your own guru and he will show the right path. But unless the grace of God is there, no liberation is possible. Lord Krishna himself has said in the Bhagavad Gita, the 11th chapter in particular, Naham Vedaihi Na Tapasa Na Daneena Na Kijaya Shekhyaha Evam Vidho Drashtam Drishtavarasanam Gita. You have seen me this cosmic form, O Arjuna. Not because you are a great scholar in the Vedas, not you are a great ascetic or accomplished in the other way, because I love you, because you are a great devotee of mine. So unless the grace of God is there, realization of the ultimate truth becomes less like impossible, is what the Hindu believes in. And a Hindu believes that the Lord takes innumerable incarnations from time to time. He alone knows how to come and when to come. Again, I go back to the Bhagavad Gita. Yada yada hi dharmasya granehu bhavati bharata abhyutthanam adharmasya tada atmanam sujamyam. Whenever Vachu subsides and unrighteousness, in the words of Swami Vivekananda, raises its ugly head, then I manifest myself. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashayaka durkutam dharma samsthapanathaya sambhavami yuge yuge. To help the virtuous to punish the evil and to re-establish dharma and form foundation, I come from time to time. No number is given here as to, no restriction for the number of incarnations. Love that a hero knows when to come and how to come. Again, what the Hindu firmly believes in. And again, a Hindu is one who makes dharma, righteousness, a good conduct, as the means of attaining the other human ends too, like artha, money, and then kama, sense desires. Unless dharma is there, the foundation, both these two are likely to drag man away from his main goal of life. is what again the Hindu believes. And whereas it is normally thought that always keep an otherworldly existence and never bother about this worldly life. It is not true. The Rig Veda, for example, says, Om Bhadram Karnevihi Sunyama Devaha Bhadram Pashyema Akshahire Yatraha Stiraihi Angaihi Tushtuvam Sahatamuhi Vyashema Devahitam Yadamayuhu. May we with strong bodies, with strong limbs, with good eyesight, good hearing capacity, live for 100 years, the span of life of a man. Full 100 years I want to live in this world. I want to live in this world. Robert Austinism here is there. So he says, again, the Rigvedic bard and the mantras in the Ayurveda also say the same thing. Om Jivema Saradashatam Nandema Saradashatam. May we live for 100 years. May we live happily for 100 years with our children and grandchildren. This is what a Hindu believes. So, having said something about the theory part of Hinduism, let me come down to the other important aspect, namely how it is practiced now in India. An ideal Hindu is one who believes in what is called the Sampradaya. Sampradiyate is Sampradaya, that is a definition that is given to you by your own guru, by maybe your father. So the tradition has been handed down to you from generation to generation. It has got a long past of it. So whatever you do must be controlled by your own sampradaya, your tradition. In fact, there are several sampradayas in India. The followers of Ramanuja have their own Ramanuja sampradaya. The sampradaya of Shankaracharya is there, of Vallabha, Chaitanya, Nimbarka, and many, many spiritual giants. And each sampradaya is right, so long as it doesn't revolt against the basic principles enumerated in the Vedas and Upanishads that have been the guideline all through. So, now if you ask me, had a question with Rama, yes, I say, what is the meaning of this verse? According to Ramanuja, I should go back to my tradition. Well, this is what Ramanuja has said. He has his own tradition behind. His guru, Yamunacharya, has taught it. His guru, Nathamuni, taught it. So, it goes back to a very deep past. So, everywhere, Sampradaya should be guiding for us. And depending upon the sanctions given in the Veda, the Hindu now enters into what is called the four stages of human life. It is what is called the Varna Dharma and Ashrama Dharma. Depending upon the caste into which you are born, you have certain duties to perform. Depending upon the stage of life you are in, as a celibate, for example, called Brahmachari, as a householder, Grihastha, or a Vanaprastha, recluse, or an anchorite, or an initiate, sannyasi, each one has his own duties, and they should never be violated. This is what again we will be practicing in here today. Now, for as I said earlier, for the discharge of one's duties, you need the guidance of a guru, a qualified spiritual preceptor. The word guru is very loosely translated as a teacher. I teach a text in Sanskrit, I'm a guru. But I am not supposed to be actually a spiritual guide, because unless I myself have what is called the license from God, as Ramakrishna Paramahansa used to say, I am not qualified to be a spiritual guide. Ramakrishna used to say, do you have the license to speak about God? What license, sir? Where is it available? Somebody asked. It's not that, he said, I have seen God yourself, face to face. That is the real license you have to speak about God. Otherwise, you are not qualified. Touching only around the circumference, then we come to the center of the topic. So, this is what a spiritual guide can do. And unless we have a guide, there is no way of salvation. The same Tyagaraja Swami, who is a great name in Carnatic music, who wrote all his verses, the songs in Telugu, he said, Guru Leka Yettivariki Mokshan. Without a guru, there is no salvation for anybody, however great the person may otherwise be. In fact, what about Rama, who is incarnation of Lord Vishnu? He too had a guru in Vasishtha. What about Lord Krishna? He is incarnation of Lord Vishnu, or perhaps according to Vedic Sampradaya, he is Supreme Brahman himself. But even he had a guru in Sandipani. So nobody can just ignore that fact. The Hindu is therefore, another point to be noted is, he is known for his remarkable spirit of tolerance regarding other religions, other practitioners too. He never loses his temper, he never angry with anybody. Indeed, if you ask them, what exactly is this single characteristic of Hindu, it is Hindu tolerance form, and everything else comes second. Take for example the Buddha. The Buddha denounced the Vedas. Nindasi yajna videhe ahaha suti jatam. Saint Jayadeva sang in him. Oh Buddha, you denounce the Vedic ritual. Why? Because animals are being slaughtered in religion, that is true. Buddha said Vedas are not Vedic. For the matter, he said, nobody should study Sanskrit at all. So he taught everything in Magadhi, the language of the people. It was well and good. But what is India doing for him? He is lifted to the position of a god himself. The Buddha is recognized as an incarnation of Lord Vishnu. So wonderful spirit of tolerance the Indians have over the centuries. So it is not merely tolerated, but encouraged even. Tolerance is a small word, I think. Buddha has been tolerated, has been encouraged to preach his own philosophy of non-Vedic performance of meditation and doctrine. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita, 7th chapter, we have a beautiful statement. Lord Krishna says, Yo, yo, yam, yam, tam, bhaktaha, shraddhaya, architum, ichyati, tasya, tasya, acharam, shraddham, tameva, yadathamiyaham. If anybody has any particular leanings towards a particular form of mind, because all these gods and gods have my own forms. Ekams of Vipraha, again, the same truth you have to keep in mind. So, if somebody is interested in worshiping a particular form, okay, I give him great faith and confidence in that. Let him worship that form and he'll be liberated. So this is what is called the great spirit of tolerance, which is characteristic of the entire Hindu nation. And again, the Hindus are open to any kind of criticism. If you have anything to say, okay, I'll prepare to listen. With an open heart, with open arms, welcome your enemy if you have something good to offer to us. The Rig Veda has a beautiful statement. Ah, no, bhadraha, kratavaha, yantu vishvataha. May noble thoughts come to us from different directions. Well, if I am able to improve myself, take care. I will verify it by that. So there is no question of closing the door against any kind of reparation of this teaching. And again, the Hindu has great regard for what is called the Go Mata, worship of a cow. Why, what is so significant about a cow? Cow is like any other animal, we may say. But the Hindus have different reasons for adoring cow, because she is called Go Mata, because not only for the simple reason that cow's milk is good, even for a child, no, don't give him buffalo milk, because the child can't digest it. It is so good for health. Cows are pure by nature, full of compassion and love. And I tell you that there is in Sanskrit what is called Vatsalya, a term. Vatsalya means parental love. Vatsa, you know what it means? The calf only. The human beings have borrowed this terminology from animal kingdom, I should say. The love that a mother cow showers upon the young one is incomparable, the whole creation. Look at any creature. The love that the mother has for the young one can see only, highly exalted, and see practically in the life of a cow. As soon as the calf is born, the mother cow licks up all the dirt with its tongue, because she wants the child to be active, energetic, and even beautiful at the same time. The humans have borrowed this word Vatsalya. Vatsalya here means parental love. So it has been borrowed from this particular expression of Vatsa, the love the mother cow has for the young one. And the reason why the Hindus worship the cow is Lord Krishna is fond of the cows. He is called Gopala. What a wonderful. Lord Krishna fondles them because they are the embodiment of dharma and love. In some Puranas, the whole creation is said to have come from different parts of the mother. Also, it is a symbol of the divine cow, the desire-yielding cow called Kamadhil. And also, you know how the Sipai Mutiny in 1857 had its beginning, which was the like a forerunner for the independence movement and struggle for independence in India, because the grenades which the soldiers were used to use were being covered by the fat taken by the cows. That's how they would start. Do anything with the cow, they won't call it. You'll be easily provoking a Hindu to do any insult or injury to the animal. Ahimsa Paramo Dharmaha is another grand truth which the Hindu believes in. Non-violence is the greatest virtue. Ahimsa is the first quality which Patanjali also expects in a sadhaka of yoga. Non-injury. Why? Because the simple reason that the whole creation is not meant for the human enjoyment only. So many creatures are born and they are born here to work out their own salvation, their own karma. And if you kill an animal and then eat it, you are preventing the law of karma and so far that animal is concerned, which is heinous thing. You will be reborn again in the same form. This is what Swami Vivekananda has said in some of his lectures. Therefore, coming again to the very important point, the Hindu adores his mother as a deity. In fact, the Shikshavali says, Om Matrudevo Bhava, Pitrudevo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Atithi Devo Bhava. Worship your mother as a goddess. Your father comes next only. Then your guru, then guests and others. And a Manu text, this Manu Smriti has a beautiful statement. Many people have not properly understood Manu and they say, oh, she doesn't want the woman to be free and so on. But they are not properly understood the text at all. Because Manu says clearly, Yatra Nayastu Pujyante Ramante Tatra Devata. The place where the women are adored, gods will be happy with that country. Yatra Yatastu Na Pujyante, supposing they are not honored anywhere, then Sarvaha Tatra Nishphalaha Kriyaha. Whatever work you may do there, will become futile, they don't bear fruit at all. This is a great place women have occupied the nation. And Hindu still honors women. If any lady whose marriage comes, I must treat Matrivatu Paradareshu. She is my mother. Oh, mother, you have to say. That's how the Hindus believe. These are the basic issues which you can see in daily practice of religion. Now, in modern times, you can say the unique merit of Hinduism is adaptability, flexibility, openness. In conformity with the changing situations and demands and challenges in modern times. Now when I say that pontiffs of various religious institutions, we call them Pitadhipatis, how they now crossing the oceans and come to Western countries to preach their own religion and philosophy to the overseas Hindus. This is a welcome change. It was not known at all in previous years. It was a taboo. To cross the ocean is banned for life. But these have changed now. The world has shrunk. And it is a welcome change that is taking place. I know at least two or three monks who have come to America and the UK to speak to overseas Hindus. And Hinduism can accommodate its bosom like the so-called proverbial Pushpara Vimana Rama, the seat for an extra person. What is seating capacity of Pushpara Vimana, in which Rama returned to Ayodhya, n plus 1. Extra seat will be there for it. So Hinduism has a place for even the so-called modern offshoots of religious systems. Well, you are very lucky. If you are able to contribute, then good thought will be your most right. So this is what Hinduism has been doing. There is no question of Hinduism saying, oh, I am holy, touching not, no, I am just one of you. Hinduism has attained in recent years, maybe for the past 200 years or so, many modern forms, various forms, and found fertile soil in the West. For example, the Swami Narayana movement, which actually started in Gujarat, Sri Ramakrishna movement, the ISKCON movement of Sri Ruba. Several missions and organizations, teachings of which propagate the teachings of Sri Aurobindo, Jyoti Krishnamurti, Bhagavan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, the spiritual regeneration movement of Mahesh Yogi for the transcendental meditation, and the Sahaja Marga propagated by Sri Ramachandraji of Shahjahanpur in Uttar Pradesh. Well, Hinduism is an everyday religion, not a Sunday religion or a one-day religion. go to India, the temples all the time open for you. I wonder if anybody has gone to Tirupati, the famous institution of Lord Venkateshwara. Darshan starts very early in the morning, Suprabhasava, by 2:30 or 3 o'clock, maybe. Darshan goes on continuously till midnight, till 1:30 or so. The Lord is given a short break only for 1.5 hours or 2 hours. Again, there will be Suprabhasava. Continuously. It's millions and millions come and throng to the temple. That is true with every other temple also in India. You go and see anybody, and see the caste mark there, you can understand what he is standing for. Well, Raji is not something extraneous, he is a part of the very life. The very breath he breathes, that is Rajam for the common man. And it is wonderful that India has, this religion in particular, has survived almost unscathed, I should say, the invasions by the Buddhists. They dominate the whole sea. But India has survived it. What about the foreign rule brought in by Muslims and the British? That also has been sustained, survived wonderfully enough. And in spite of the so-called modern industrialization, which according to Weber brings in what is called secularization and then disintegration of the nation, nothing has happened of the sort. It is still a thriving religion. Thus, my dear sisters and brothers, I have attempted to place before you only some salient features of the Hindus, their beliefs and practices. All Indians are not Hindus, and all Hindus are not staying in India only. Yet, the saga of Hinduism and the land is so closely interconnected with the land and life of India, so that we cannot think of the other one without thinking of the other. According to the census report prepared in 2001 in India, the population of India stands at a staggering figure of 1,027 million. 1,027 million, of which 85% are Hindus. India is today called a secular state. That means they respect all religions alike. In this sense, India is the world in miniature. If we are ever to be united, we must love one another. And if we want to love one another, we should know and understand one another. If we have to know and understand one another, we have to meet one another, then discuss a friendly atmosphere if there are differences. You can start out. Understandably. Understanding India and Hinduism holds the key to the better understanding of the world in which we are living and which we are wending our ways to the same goal, namely bliss here and in the hereafter. This is what the Vedic bards of the wonder and splendor that was and is India sang ages ago. The Vedic bards have said, Om Sangachadvam Samvadadvam Samvo Manamsi Jatam. My dear friends, come together. Sangachadvam Samvadadvam. Open up your mouth to say something. Try to understand each other. Samvo Manamsi Jatam. Only there lies the clue for our welfare. Friendliness, you will have. Om Mitrasya Aham Chakshusha Sarvani Bhutani Samipche. Om Mitrasya Chakshusha Sarvani Bhutani Mam Samikshantam. May look at the entire creation with the eyes of a friend. May all the living beings also look at me with the eye of a friend. Om Shantihi Shantihi Shantihi. Let there be peace. Let there be peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Narasimhacharya. Now, I will request our Professor Francis Explonius Chair who you all heard the last seminar, last meeting, Professor Thoreau.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all of you for being here tonight. I'd like to thank Mr. Patel and the IK Foundation for inviting me. I'm very happy that those of you who heard me the last time were willing to come back, so that's a good sign. Two other things I should say as we begin. Secondly, I'm very honored also to follow after Professor Narasimhachari. You've heard his enormous learning, his breadth of understanding of the culture, and his lovely and remarkable ability, which I wish I had and do not have, to quote from Sanskrit texts so beautifully and to even sing some of the verses for us. I was thinking to myself before that if I was ever in the position of being reborn as a Hindu, then I might actually want to be reborn as Professor Narasimhachari. So. But finally, I'd like to complain. Last time I was here, you may recall that I spoke on the topic of Western views of India, Western views of Hindus. And I felt a bit rude telling you what Westerners think about you. But now it's getting worse, because this time it's who's a Hindu? And I'm not a Hindu. I mean, I've been thinking about Hindu things for some 30 years now. I love being in India. I think I'm at home in India the way I am in New York. But I'm not a Hindu, and I feel very embarrassed having to speak to you on this topic tonight, so you'll have to have my patience, or I expect your patience. And then finally, I'm very glad that I will not be here for the lecture in the fall on who should your daughter marry, because I would definitely get into great trouble if I took up that topic. Nonetheless, what I would like to do in the brief time I have, because I'd like to finish by 9 so we can have questions and wonderful food like last time, what I would like to do is really take up the question of who's a Hindu from several different angles, really building on the great foundation of what Professor has given to us already. But first of all, kind of asking the question, what do Westerners think a Hindu is? And why do Westerners care about this question? And then to turn to the question, a very much related question, should you care about the answer to that question? And then thirdly, kind of as a footnote at the end of my reflection, if we're wondering about who is a Hindu, shouldn't we also ask the question, well, who is not a Hindu? And I think this will fill my time. In a recent book, Professor Julius Lipner, who teaches at Cambridge University, lists at the beginning of a book called The Hindus, Their Religious Beliefs and Practices, he lists a number of definitions of what people have said about Hindus through the centuries. And I'll just read you several of them. Hinduism is a way of life and a highly organized social and religious system. The acceptance of the Veda as revealed scripture is certainly the most basic criterion for anyone to declare himself a Hindu. Hinduism actually, these are all different views, Hinduism is actually not a religion, but a collection of religions, containing elements of shared tradition, religions that have continually influenced one another through the ages, and that have formed the culture of India. Another person says, caste is the Hindu form of social organization. No one can be a Hindu who does not belong to a caste. And then someone else adds, the caste system, although it is closely integrated into Hindu religions, is actually not that important for being a Hindu. Even profession of belief in the authority of the Veda is not actually essential. And so on. Western scholars, from the ones I mentioned to you last time I was here, for the last 4 or 5 centuries, have been asking the question, who is a Hindu and what is Hinduism? And I think we could fill up the entire time by adding more quotations, such as Professor Lipner has put before us at the beginning of his book, all the different attitudes and different views that people have had. But I think after a while, we can become frustrated and say, perhaps it's not really an important question. Perhaps it's not something that we need to take up a lovely evening in May to talk about. Perhaps it's actually a fact that all of you somehow are living the lives you're living. You've figured out what to do when you're born and what to do when you die and what to do when you marry and what to eat and what not to eat. So it seems to work in practice. And I think some of you may be impatient with the question, why do they keep asking this question about who's a Hindu? So what I'd like to do just for a few minutes first is reflect on some of the reasons why I think Westerners have thought this to be an important question. The first reason, I think, has to do with what it means to be a Christian, if we take the Western Christians as the example. Because I think the long history of Christianity in the West, where you had the biblical culture, then you had Greek culture, then you had the different European cultures, then you had the Reformation, where you had the church, I'm sorry, you had the breakup of East and West, the Orthodox churches and the Roman church. Then you had the different Protestant communities started to develop over against the Roman Catholic Church. Then you had the church spreading throughout the world and all new cultures and so on. I think it's been a very hard and difficult issue for Christians through the centuries to decide what does it actually mean to be a Christian. And some Christians will say the basic thing is to follow Jesus Christ. The basic thing is to believe in the Bible completely. The basic thing, I'm a Roman Catholic, is to accept the authority of the church and the Pope. The basic thing is to be nonviolent. The basic thing is to love your neighbor. And all these different views, I think Christians have tortured ourselves over the centuries, wondering about what it means to be a Christian. And because we've learned to fight about it, and for hundreds of years, we're fighting back and forth about true Christianity versus false Christianity and so on, I think at a certain point people said, no, wait a minute. Maybe people should be religious, but it's more important that we have social and cultural structures that are not overwhelmed by religion. And I think scholars in the 17th and 18th century started to ask themselves, let's figure out what Christianity actually is so that we can sort of put it over here or put it on Sunday morning or put it in the quietness of your heart, and then we can have culture in general, society in general, which are not covered over by the idea of religious values and religious dogmas filling the culture. So I think when Christians started thinking about India and started thinking about what does it mean to be a Hindu, they had already been thinking about what does it mean to be a Christian. And I think it's not a sign of arrogance usually, or it's not a sign of intrusion to be able to raise the question and say, well, what is Hinduism? What are Hindus? Because Christians had been doing it for themselves and trying to find some small essence of being Christian to say, that's it, I've got that, I can let go of the rest. Now, to be honest, there's also a second reason. I think Westerners through the centuries, again, with the experience of being Christians, if I'm just sticking with the Christian context in the West, the experience of being Christian knows that a lot of things have gone by the name of Christian over the centuries that actually are not very admirable. A lot of things Christians have done that are not very moral. A lot of things Christians have believed that seem, in retrospect, centuries later, to be superstition, or to be things that is just as well forgotten and left in the past. And I think there's a certain sense that Westerners have had that every religion is like a big attic, the attic in your house or your garage out back. And the basic thing is there are a couple of good things in there, and the rest of it can be embarrassing as time passes. And so I think when many Western scholars began to think about India, they said, well, of course India must be the same way. There's lots of stuff in India. There's 1 billion pounds of stuff in India. Everything is filled and complicated in various ways. Let's try to get at what's really good about being Indian, or really good about being religiously in the majority of India, let's say being Hindu. And then the rest of it we can say, well, that's superstition, or that's social custom, or that's just what people do, and we can let it go and let it pass away. And so part of the time when Westerners are asking the question, what is Hindu, they really mean, well, what is not Hindu, and what can people let go of as they improve themselves and become modern people and live in the modern world? I must also admit that there's also a missionary element. My name is Francis Xavier, and the first of the Jesuit missionaries to go to India was Francis Xavier in 1540, and he went to Goa. And the long tradition of the missionaries in India was to figure out what is Indian and what is Hindu, so that we can drop the Hindu part and keep the Indian part. And I think, while even Francis Xavier was a great holy person, I think, and had the best of intentions, he was obviously doing something that you yourselves would not do, say, oh, an Indian over here and Hindu over there. But I think, again, when Westerners ask the question, they're often asking, if we can only identify the Western part, the Indian part and the Hindu part, then we can separate them to keep the one and drop the other. And that's certainly one strand of Western thought. In more modern times, I think it's just become an intellectual question in itself. Many Westerners, particularly great scholars at places like Cambridge and Oxford and different universities in America, have become fascinated by trying to go from religions in the plural to religion in the singular. So not even worrying about what's a Christian or what's a Hindu, but what does it mean to be a religious person? What's the essence of religion? What's the pure essence of being spiritual? And for intellectual reasons, and for some people connected with personal, devotional reasons, it became a great academic topic to see if we can look at different religions and then out of it pull the essence, what is the one thing that identifies what religion is all about? And part of the ways that Westerners have done this is by saying, well, let's look at the history of things that people call religion. So let's not just talk about Christianity, but let's talk about first century Christianity, third century Christianity in England, Christianity in France, Christianity in the Philippines, Christianity in India. Let's look at the history of these traditions and try to find the essence. And likewise, then, turning to other religions, not just Hinduism, but Buddhism or Jainism or Judaism, say, let's look at the history and say, what was going on in India 4,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago? What was going on in 1500? What are the things that have changed over time? And can't we come up with kind of the continuities and differences in Indian culture? And then can't we compare them all? So let's take elements of Christian tradition, elements of Islam, elements of Buddhism, elements of Hinduism, and again, compare them back and forth so we finally know what it means to be religious. And I think for many Western scholars, asking what's a Hindu, who's a Hindu, is simply part of that larger academic inquiry about what does it mean to be religious in the first place. If we can figure that out, then we can say there's Hindu being religious, Christian being religious, Jew being religious, and so on. But finally, I must admit also, if you read books written in the last 25 years by Western scholars, including the book I mentioned by Professor Lipner from Cambridge University, most Western scholars, I think, realize the enormous richness of the tradition to which Professor Narasimhacharya points us. And they realize, finally, there is so much going on here, probably we're not going to come up with a single definition. And so I know scholars, serious scholars, who actually love India and love to go to India and love to study the different traditions of India. Some of them will only use the word Hinduism in the plural. There is no such thing as Hinduism. There is only Hinduisms. And they simply refuse to use the singular at all. And then some people won't use any word that begins with H-I-N-D-U. Say no. There are Vaishnavas, there are Shaivas, there are Tantrikas, there are different local traditions in parts of India. Good scholars should not use this word at all. And I know several people have read things I've written where I tend sometimes to use the word Hindu or Hinduism. They'll say, oh, you got into trouble there because you're using that word for something that doesn't exist. And so for some scholars, the answer would be, who's a Hindu? Nobody's a Hindu. And that's not a very positive point, I suppose. But now, secondly, why should you care about this question? And again, I'm being sort of, well, you invited me to speak, so I guess I can't say I'm being impolite, but I am going to tell you what I think you should be thinking for a few minutes. Basically, why would this matter to you? You're not Christians, for the most part, I'm sure. You're not Westerners, for the most part. You didn't grow up with some of the things I was just talking about. But I'd simply like, for the interest of time, just to list a number of things, reasons that I think you might have for concern about this topic. First of all, that I think there is a tradition in India of saying that Hinduism is defined by the Veda. Hinduism is defined by Sanatana Dharma. Hinduism is defined by the great Varnashrama Dharma system. And I think you have to ask yourself in the year 2002, and in 2010 and 2020, do you really believe that the values of the Sanskrit Brahmanical tradition are the values that you want to live and die by? We all know that Sanskrit is the greatest of the language traditions of India, and that Brahmanism is the greatest achievement of Indian culture, I think. But I think you have to ask yourself honestly and ask one another, do you really want kind of a classic Sanskritic understanding of India and Hinduism to be the beginning and end of how you describe yourself religiously? And if you don't, then you have to ask the question, well, if I'm not just going to say it's this and this and this according to the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Gita, then what else are you going to say about who you are? Try to describe yourself as a Hindu without using any words that come from the Sanskrit language. Let's see if you can do that. Secondly, I think this is a hot political topic, right? I mean, there are debates in India today. There are troubles all around the country about Hindutva. And I think for those of you who, I'm sure it's all of you, who love India, who love the Indian traditions, who care about communal harmony in the different states of India today, have to be asking the question, what's the difference between Hindutva and being a Hindu? Are they the same, in fact? Or what's the difference between Hindutva, being a Hindu, and being an Indian? And as you know, this can be a nice theoretical question also, but also can have a lot to do with education, with social policy, with political parties, with respect for places of worship, and so on. And I think if you're going to be kind of responsible 21st century Indians who care about India, then to sort out Hindutva, Hindu, Indian is something that you and your children's generation really have to face. Thirdly, you're here. You're not, in fact, at least at the moment, you're not in India. You're here in the UK. And in fact, you're living in a culture, as I was describing a few minutes ago, where, in fact, for generations, Christians and Westerners have been thinking about definitions of religion and kind of ID card definitions of I'm a Christian, I'm a Presbyterian, I'm an Anglican, I'm a Roman Catholic, I'm an Orthodox Jew, I'm a Hasidic Jew, I'm a Sunni Muslim, I'm a Shiite Muslim, etc., etc., etc. And I think, like it or not, when you find yourself living in the UK or in Canada or in the United States or similar countries, part of being here is not simply dressing like a Westerner, but there's all the cultural stuff of being in the West and the cultural stuff of speaking English and kind of living in this world. And if most of your neighbors are able to describe fairly exactly, well, I'm actually a Presbyterian, a Methodist, a Roman Catholic, then you have to decide for yourselves, and your children have to decide too, do you want the label to be Hindu? So you're a Presbyterian, I'm a Hindu. You're a Roman Catholic, I'm a Hindu. Or is it going to be, well, no, let's forget the word Hindu. I'm a Vaishnava, I'm a Sri Vaishnava, I'm a Gaudiya Vaishnava. I'm a Swami Narayan devotee. What is the word that you're going to use to talk about yourself when your neighbor is using these words for Jewish and Christian and Muslim and so on? And I don't think you can avoid that. I think it's part of being in the UK to be able to say about yourself articulately, not, oh, it's a great mystery, nobody knows what Hindu means, but to have some kind of intelligent answer to the question, well, if you're religious, how are you religious? And is Hindu the word you want to use? I would add as a footnote to that, because time is running short, that this is not simply you sit down someday and you sort of think up an answer and then you have an answer. But I think occasions like this and future occasions and centers like this and the IK Foundation really create opportunities, probably that are very hard to find in India itself, where people from all different parts of India, all different language groups, all different guru traditions, all different temple practices, all different everything of the Indian context, are sitting next to one another and talking to one another, and where, for the first time perhaps in history, Hindus from Gujarat and Kashmir and Tamil Nadu and Kerala are suddenly mixing and living next to one another and going to places of worship on weekends and so on. And to do the hard work of not simply saying, well, this is what I think because this is what my grandmother thought, but to be able to sit down and say, all right, I know, I'm a Sri Vaishnava, and you're from Gujarat. You're probably not a Sri Vaishnava. Or I'm from Bombay, and you probably don't believe the same thing that the people in Calcutta believe. Well, not just to say that in general, but to say, all right, I'm from Gujarat. Do I ever go to Sri Vaishnava temples? I am a devotee of Ramakrishna. Have I ever gone to Shaiva temples? Etc., etc., you get my point. About learning from one another, and not sort of saying, well, we have many different traditions in India, but actually, I have experienced traditions other than the one I was born into. I have learned about how other people who call themselves Hindu have practiced their faith. I am a devotee of Krishna, but I have begun to feel what it means to worship Kali. I am a devotee of Shiva, but I realize why people give their lives to service of Lord Rama. And that kind of thing, to learn from one another that way. Next point, education. I think obviously the task, and probably why many of you are here tonight, is that, in fact, you have to teach your children something. And because you're living here and you're not living in India, you can't just sort of assume it's in the culture and breathing the air will somehow it will continue. But part of the thing you have to do, and I know many of you are involved in education at local temples, you have to be able to sort of give your Sunday school course, so to speak, on what it means to be Hindu. And I think I learned, like I'm addressing this topic tonight, so I've had to think about it. And whenever you're in a position where you take a young person and have to try to explain something from the start, you have to sort of say, all right, this is what it means to be 13 years old, living in London in the year 2002. What can I possibly say to my child that's going to make sense of all of this? You know, the same kid who uses computer games and watches Star Wars movies and reads all these new books and does science and so on. How can I explain the traditions of my family and where we come from in a way that a child born in this country today, who may not even know your native language very well, is able to understand and grasp? And that's a big challenge. And again, I think you have the option of using the word Hindu and sort of communicate to your children, this is what it means to be a Hindu, as Professor Narasimhacharya was explaining so nicely. These are the things we believe as a Hindu. But I think you also have to ask yourself, how many things can I say to my children that they'll actually believe? And I'm a Catholic priest, and I know lots of things I can say in church that 13-year-olds or 15-year-olds aren't going to believe. They'll say, he's an old man, what does he know? And I'm sure you're going to have the same experience. You can say this, you can say this, you can say this, but do you have a living understanding of Hindu? Or whatever other word you want to use that will make sense to your children. But also education on the highest level. I mean, you know, you should know, and you're all successful people, that education doesn't just happen, but education is a great kind of economic creation. Education is an economic and social achievement. Education is a large process of money and power and influence and generations of people running things. And I think there's a danger, if you're sort of inarticulate as believers, that it could be generations from now before Hindu studies or Hindu religious traditions are really central in universities here in America and Canada and so on. And I think you have to be able to say, oh, not that we believe all these nice things and the Americans and the Europeans teach them, but rather, how can we take up kind of the academic, intellectual, historical, linguistic, social, political study of the traditions that you were all born into in such a way that they can be recognizable and central in philosophy departments and theology programs here in the UK and abroad. And that's not just going to happen by expecting some nice Westerner to do it. But you have to be the ones to say, no, wait a minute, at Oxford University there are 73 faculty teaching Christianity and maybe 1.5 teaching Hinduism. And to not just say, well, see, that's what they're like. But somehow to figure out how can we change this and have intellectual study of these traditions and put them together in a forceful new way. And again, part of that requires asking yourself the same questions. Can I think about this? Can I process it? Can I sort out the changes? Can I do all of this in my children so that 20, 30 years from now, Hinduism is a regular part of religion and philosophy syllabi in different parts of the world? And by extension, I just add one more point to that, and then I just have a couple more points and I'll stop. Is that basically, this can expand out into politics. I mean, I'm from the United States, as you may guess. And in the United States, religion has a big role in politics and social policy. And there's the moral majority and the Christian right and the Christian left and different groups that are involved in ecology and so on. And politicians pay attention because they know there are kind of constituencies who have deep religious values about sexual issues, about abortion and so on. And this make a big difference in the culture. And I think although you all have different values and different traditions, you probably have so much in common. And you have to be able to ask yourself, what are the Hindu values that we would like to see lived in the UK? What are the values, not simply we have them because we're Indian and we brought them with us, but rather that I would like to share with all people in the UK, and I would like to see them to be government policy and social policy. And I think to do that, you have to be able to ask yourselves, well, what are the values relevant to the 21st century that we have as Hindus? And then how can we translate these into social and political values? Finally, my last point, who's not a Hindu? I think one of the ways to describe who's in a group is to describe who's outside it. And I think to some extent you can get off with a fairly easy answer. The only people who are not Hindus are those who say they're not Hindus. And just about everybody in the world then might be actually a Hindu because of really the genius, I think, of your insights, of your tradition, about the self, about Brahman, about how the world is connected and so on. And you might be able simply to get off by saying, well, if they don't say they're not a Hindu, then they are a Hindu. And there's a certain wisdom to that, but I think it also may be too easy and too polite. And so I think you need to ask yourself further questions, and I'll just give you three to finish. Is it true that perhaps the people who are really not Hindus in this world are Jews, Christians, and Muslims? Possibly because of the monotheistic traditions of the West, possibly because of the first commandment in the book of Exodus, you shall have only one God before you. Possibly because of Christian history, possibly because of the dynamic of Islam, that when you're talking about being Hindu, particularly in the Indian context, but also here, we really mean we're Hindu except if you happen to be Jewish or Christian or Muslim. Now, it's not a polite thing to say, and I'm not even recommending it, but I think it's something to think about, that when you think of who's not Hindu, aren't you often talking about groups like Jews, Christians, and Muslims? Secondly, one of the things I found personally in India, when I learned I was not a Hindu, was when I tried to get into the great temple at Sri Ranga. And there was a sign, like at the third prakaram of the temple, Hindus only beyond this point. And I tried to persuade them in various ways. I just want darshan. I just want to go in and see the Lord there, and this is fine. And I'm not going to take pictures, and I'm not going to write an expose or anything. I just want to come in and have darshan. They said, sorry, you're not a Hindu. And I said, I'll put on a dhoti, then I'll be a Hindu. Sorry, no, you look silly in a dhoti. Don't put on a dhoti. I'll put mark on my head, then I'll be a Hindu. No, and there was nothing I could do. And there were several other temples, too. And I wonder if it had something to do with, you know, or I'm a vegetarian for many years, but you think about Westerners, they eat meat, they drink alcohol, they smoke cigarettes, they're impure. And basically, to not be a Hindu is to be impure. And you haven't, I think, yet probably at the temples here in the UK put up Hindu-only signs, because that would be bad policy with your neighbors. But do any of you have in your heart of hearts a sense the pure are the Hindus and the impure are the others? And again, it's not a polite question to ask, but to have an instinct in your heart about why is it that the Sri Rangam temple can have a sign, Hindus only, and what is it you're keeping out? And when you talk about your families and your lives and your weddings and your children, what do you want to keep out? Who, what kind of people you say, they're not Hindu, they're not like us, please stay at a distance. And finally, last question, a last point, what do you do with the fact that now there are Westerners who have become and call themselves Hindu? Professor Narasimhacharya referred to this. We have the esteemed Shonaka Rishidas, who seems to be Irish as far as I can tell. And you have the phenomenon now in the West, in America, here in the UK, of people who have never been Indian, at least in this lifetime, who have never been Indian, who don't speak Sanskrit properly, many of them, although Sanskrit, Shonaka's Sanskrit is lovely, but many people who simply aren't part of India. And you have the phenomenon now of an increasing number of people, also following yoga teachers and all that, who say, I'm a Hindu and I'm not an Indian. And I wonder, do you realize the implications of that? Christians in the first century had to say, you can be a Christian without being Jewish. And maybe in the 21st century, for the first time, it may be hitting you in the face, that suddenly there is kind of a global reach, and you're faced with people who don't look like Indians, but call themselves Hindu. Are you willing to live with that reality and expand your definition of Hindu to fit these new brothers and sisters in? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Clooney. Now, before we start the question and answer sessions, I would now request Shaunaka Rishidas to address us for a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Bhai. Jai Shri Krishna. I'm just going to talk just for a couple of minutes and just give a couple of little announcements as well. But basically, the IK Foundation has very generously sponsored this series of lectures. It's kind of Oxford coming to London. And we have these wonderful professors who are teaching, giving 32 classes in this term in Oxford, just in this 8 weeks in Oxford. So all this wonderful learning, and it's all happening up there among the select few. So we thought it was very important that we can import this knowledge into the community here. The center through which we're doing it is the Oxford Center for Vaishnava and Hindu Studies. It was started in 1997. The door was opened, ironically enough, not by the Hindu community, but by the academic community in Oxford, who thought this was a very important initiative and that the community needs to be involved in this initiative. So a bridge has been built to the extent that we can have a wonderful practitioner scholar like Professor Narasimha Acharya and a wonderful scholar who is actually a Jesuit priest like Francis X. Clooney, able to teach together students of the same subject and bring them up and ask them extremely relevant questions to help develop our tradition in scholarship so that we can end up with articulate representatives of our tradition. So that's one of the aims of the centre. This brochure is available at the back of the hall when you leave. Everyone is invited to take one. One thing we want to do is next October, November, we want to start a Hindu studies course here in London. So if anyone here would like to, again, this is Oxford in London, we've been very encouraged by the turnout of these lectures. There's obviously a thirst for this kind of subject and good teaching on it. And the idea is really to take the subject of, for instance, this evening's subject, what is a Hindu? But not necessarily, we don't want to answer the question. We just want to unpack the question. Just take out the constituent parts and let everyone decide for themselves. Here's how you could look at it, make your own decision. Maybe you want to take it back to your swamis or gurus and ask them, but at least begin to think about this, become very thoughtful about our tradition in the context in which we live. The Hindu Studies course, if you want to participate, please write down your name, address, and your email address so that we can contact you when the course is going to happen. Every 3 months we send out a newsletter and also a lecture list of all the lectures that are happening in Oxford for people who may want to attend, and some people will come. And also, the IK Foundation have been very kind. They suggested after the last lecture there was such an interest that they set up these three tables, and the professors and other representatives from the centre will be there after the lecture, during the meal, so anyone who wants to come over and just have further discussion, etc. And we're going to have questions and answers now, and how we're going to do it is... Is it on this piece of paper, Harish? Yep, okay. At the bottom of this piece of paper, if you have a question, write your question down, and there'll be Ravi Gupta. Ravi! One person, and Hari won't do it. Google? Hari? There'll be different agents around the place to whom you can give your questions, and we'll send them up to the speakers. And please write down who you want to answer the question if you have a specific question for a specific person. Okay, thank you very much.
So, ladies and gentlemen, your questions, please.
What we will do, and we'll try to be as quick as possible and therefore not give really good answers, but short answers at least, is alternate back and forth, except if the question has a name on it, like Professor Narasimha Acharya. So he actually has the first one there. How relevant is caste system in 21st century? Again, we could both do this, but my view is it is relevant. It is certainly, anyone who thought it's not relevant would be living in a dream world. But I think relevance meaning changes, and what it meant to be in the Varnashrama system 3,000 years ago had a certain meaning. It meant something in the Middle Ages. To be in the caste system in 1960 meant something else. I think you have to not abandon traditional values, but recreate them for the modern age. And therefore you have to ask yourself, why would we keep an idea like caste? And then how can we transform it and give it new life in this century? And then maybe some of you would actually want to change it altogether, but that's a start. But again, we have to keep our answers short and maybe follow up afterwards in discussion.
Why did Buddhism did not flourish in India? The first speaker, please. So thank you for the question. You know why? Because there came a great soul, Shankara, who, with his commentary on the Prasthana Treya, that is the triple text, which laid down the details about one's code of conduct, means of liberation and so on, Shankara was the first critic to denounce and defeat the Buddhist arguments. Because you know why Buddha was not honored in India, the place where the residents of Dara? Because he said Vedas are not valid. There was something anathema, incredible for an Indian to follow. It is true that Buddha taught the same principles adumbrated in Hindu religion. I said earlier, Ahimsa Paramo Dharma. What Buddha taught was ahimsa only, non-injury to the animals, that is true. But what he did was, he said, okay, Sanskrit is not necessary. He taught people in their own local tongue. That is good. Knowledge came to them, but dignity was lost. As Swami Vivekananda says, knowledge came to them, but what is the medium which it has come? They have neglected the Sanskrit language. Instead of condemning those who know Sanskrit, try to elevate others to the level so that they can also study Sanskrit. And Shankara is the first Vedantin, I should say, who paved the way for the subsequent acharyas like Ramanuja, Vallabha, Madhva and Chaitanya, because it was easier for them, because they need not anymore deal with the so-called Buddhism. Buddhism has been driven out, as it were, from Indian soil, thanks to the glorious work done by Shankara. Because he established Vedantism and function.
Okay. Quick answers to two difficult questions. And it doesn't mean that they're easy questions, but do them quickly. Sorry, I was taught that you can be a Hindu by birth only. You cannot convert into the religion. Please comment. I think that is a legitimate view that some people might hold. If you're not born into it, you can't be it. But I think the other is also legitimate, that in fact, there is nothing intrinsically about worshipping Lord Krishna, being a devotee of Kali or Rama, such that one could not make an intelligent choice to do that as an adult. And I think anyone, it would be a wonderful thing for a conversation among yourselves. What do you think, as I said at the end of my talk, about people who claim to be Hindu who were clearly not born Hindu? Personally, I would think that one can do this, but I'm not the one to decide. And the second one I'll take, and then I'll back off for a minute. How has anthropology contributed to the ideas of Hinduism? And I think it's a wonderful example of how modern learning and modern academic culture has changed the way we've thought about India. 100 years ago, most of what Westerners thought about India was by reading texts, reading books. But in the 20th century, anthropologists became interested in village life, in ordinary practices of everyday life, in temple worship. And I think anthropologists have taught Westerners that Hinduism isn't just the Veda Upanishads as books,